I'm going to introduce Lauren Rogers, our second international speaker, all the way from the US, from the National Centre for Employee Ownership, who will share some of the lessons from the US with us. Welcome, Lauren.
Let me first say thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. It's a privilege to talk with you today, and thank you to Angela and everybody at Employee Ownership Australia and New Zealand who has set up this trip. I'm not a competitive man. I am, however, in awe of all that Graham and the folks in the United Kingdom have accomplished recently. We have some things that I think are good models as well that I'd like to share with you. But in terms of how the United States and the United Kingdom compare, at least one way we're ahead. We have October for us, which is actually Employee Ownership Month. And have had for the last 15 or so years. So we don't have many of the things that the UK has in that that you'll be doing for Employee Ownership Day. So I think actually your day is probably worth at least our month. But, let me talk to you briefly about some of what I'll cover in this presentation. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the current status of employee ownership in the United States. I'd like to give you a very brief history of how we got to where we are now. And then also I'd like to focus on the impact that employee ownership has had on companies and our society, on employees in the United States. And I'd also like to share, I think I called them lessons in this slide, but I guess they're more intended to be thought-provoking ideas for you as you consider what you want to build here in Australia and in New Zealand. Some of our lessons, some of what we've learned will be relevant to you, and some of it will be things that you can learn not to do, and some of it will be things that I think you'll want to choose to ignore, perhaps. A few things that, just to start off with, that are differences between the U.S. and the U.K. We have, there are a lot of details in our plans that work out differently than they do in the United Kingdom. There's also a pretty substantial difference in how trusts operate with regard to employee ownership in the U.S. and the U.K., and I'll talk about that in a little more detail. Another interesting difference, I think, between the U.S. and the U.K. is where the big bang of employee ownership came from in our two countries. Clearly, right now, Graham is at the heart of a big bang of creating new momentum and infrastructure to support employee ownership in the United Kingdom. Our big bang happened well over, just about 40 years ago now, in 1973, and I'll come back to that background a little bit. We've had a lot of support for it since then, but the major creation behind employee ownership in the United States happened long ago. So with that said, let me first take you on a tangent, if you don't mind. I'd like to give you a sense for the potential of employee ownership by looking at some very diverse companies in four different countries. I'll do that as a way to set up the potential of employee ownership before talking about the United States specifically. At the end of showing you those examples from the four countries and a few examples of companies in the United States, I'd like to propose 10 parameters that you ought to be conscious of as business owners, as policymakers, as you design employee ownership to be appropriate for your own companies, your own clients, and your country for your policy. So let me first take you to a company, Cambodia, where the tax law is 68 pages long, and that counts the cover. They're small pages. I've read the entire tax law of Cambodia, and it didn't take long, and it was not confusing. Cambodia is obviously a country with a very dynamic economy. Phnom Penh is a simply amazing, dynamic, vibrant city. One thing about Cambodia is its stock market, which opened last year and has one company trading on it now. One of the companies that brokers deals on the stock market is a bank called Acleda, which has a rooster as their logo for some reason I'm afraid I don't understand. Acleda is the largest bank in Cambodia. It has about 7,000 employees, about 234 branches when last I checked. And Acleda Bank is 19% owned by its employees. the mechanism by which employees own those shares is that a portion of their base compensation and a portion of their bonuses are paid to them in the form of company shares. So it's not a salary sacrifice. It's not a purchase that employees make. At Aclata Bank, one thing they've done is they wanted to make sure that everybody had a chance to get the cash value of those shares. So they decided they wanted to create an internal market. They did that by having 4 days set aside each year when people could fill out a piece of paper. They eventually decided that wasn't working very well. So Aclata built an online trading system. So now they've got it set up so that every day there are two windows over lunch and just after work where people can trade shares online. There are very few restrictions on it. If you have 100 shares or fewer, you can't sell because they want to ensure that everybody has at least some ownership stake. They did have a problem, however. They originally had the online trading system open all day long, and it was so distracting because people cared so much about these shares. They weren't getting their work done. So they narrowed the windows to there, just lunch and after work. Another extremely different example from Cambodia is South Africa. And Angela and I had a chance to learn a little bit more about the system there. In South Africa, rather than having internal markets or a very, tax law has very little to do with employee ownership in Cambodia, but it has everything to do with employee ownership in South Africa. In South Africa, employee ownership is not primarily a means of building more productive businesses. It's not primarily a means of aligning the interests of employees. It's not primarily a means of ensuring the succession of small businesses remaining South African. It's primarily, in South Africa, a means of addressing racial injustice. It grows out of the Black Economic Empowerment Act in South Africa. And just to take an example of a company, one called Tranter Holdings, is a South African-owned company, which uses the Black Economic Empowerment Act framework to create shareholders among people who are, well, in South Africa, they're legally defined as black, which is a legal category. But Tranter decided that they wanted to go beyond that and open up the share ownership to people of all races in the country. Their CEO is a man named Joshua Ngomo, and he spoke to the conference where we were. It's the only time I have ever seen a chief executive officer of a large company dance as part of a PowerPoint presentation. And it was among the most inspiring things I have seen in my life. It's an incredible story at Tranter. And it's something that I think we can all learn from, with, in this case, Cambodia and South Africa coming from radically different places, but both building inspiring examples of employee ownership. So next let me take you to Ukraine. I went to Ukraine, this is a slightly personal story. My background was an interest in Slavic Europe, and I was trying to, well, as a graduate student, I wanted to go to Ukraine because they were privatizing just after the collapse of the Soviet Union by creating employee-owned businesses in their small and medium business sector. They had created an extensive way to do that through an employee lease scheme, which was a very interesting way to solve a couple problems. They wanted to get companies in the hands of employees. Employees didn't have money. The businesses were, hopefully, generating some profit. So why not use that annual profit to lease the businesses over the course of, say, 5 years and have employees run them and earn the benefit of running those businesses? So I called up a consulting firm in Lviv and said, hey, do you have any clients that are employee-owned? And they said, sure, dozens of them. And so I set up the plane ticket, I arranged the visa, showed up in Lviv, and it turns out what they meant by employee-owned firm was this. This is a kiosk. There's one dude who fits in here. He sells the newspapers and the chocolate and the coffee and the cigarettes, and he owns that kiosk. He's the employee, he's the owner. So what they meant by come work for us was help us unload this semi-truck filled with Milka chocolate bars and Jacob Suchard coffee. So I did that. I carried their big boxes of stuff and helped them supply people. But what was interesting in some ways is this actually was a better example of employee ownership than those leased businesses. Because those leased businesses, it was more than one person, But this person's an entrepreneur. This is someone who's building a business and is going to hire more people eventually, get another kiosk. The leased businesses, they had no incentive to run those businesses well. They had every incentive to take the assets of those businesses and turn them into this year's profit. They didn't care what the business was worth in 5 years because the lease ran out then. So despite the fact that this had nothing to do, legally speaking, with employee ownership, it was a lot more like employee ownership than what was nominally the employee ownership strategy in Ukraine. So the last company, country I'd like to show you is the Basque region of Spain. And several of you have probably heard of a company called Mondragon, which is the flagship worker cooperative in the world. They're a quite amazing company. They were founded in 1956 by a Catholic priest whose name is Arizmendi Arrieta. I'm sure you all wrote that down. And they've done simply amazing things. They're the seventh largest industrial concern in Spain now. They have businesses around the world. They have some quite impressive numbers. The first four bullets there, I think, are fairly typical of what you might see of a large industrial concern. But the last one's quite interesting. They've got a bit over 1% of their workforce actively involved in democratic governance of this business. And when I say democratic, I mean democratic. It's one person, one vote. They have a series of councils and governing bodies that run their businesses. Now, there's a myth that democracy doesn't work in the workplace. And there are lots of examples of places where it has failed. However, it does work. There are examples such as Mondragon, where you can find real democracy, genuine democracy, in the governance of an effective, efficient, productive, not slow-moving behemoth organization. So those are four companies, four countries. Let me talk to you just a little bit about the United States. And before I get into those 10 parameters, let me show you a few examples of companies. I was delighted to hear Tony Smith talk about Jack Stack, who is a hero of mine and just spoke at our conference a few weeks ago. Our conference had 1,063 people or so last week, almost entirely from the United States. And I think that in 5-10 years, many of you will look back, talk to each other at the Employee Ownership Australia-New Zealand conference and say, hey, do you remember when we all fit in one room? So Jack Stack is an inspiring speaker, and his story is inspiring. The company was about to go bankrupt. It was going to be spun off from a huge industrial concern, Industrial Harvester. The managers got together, pulled a little bit of money, about $100,000. Then they convinced a bank to lend them 89 times that amount of money. So they had a debt-to-equity ratio of 89 to 1. The loan officer who made that loan was fired. They created a successful business. They turned over ownership to all employees as soon as they could do it, and they built a system of open book management, which is inspiring today. And I think open book management and building business literacy is one of the keys to making employee ownership work. It's the synergy of getting people to think and have the skills of owners with actually having them be owners that makes for the amazing results. And I'll share some data with you on that in just a minute. Another example is an insurance broker. They're a few blocks away from our office in Oakland, California. And I say that partly to point out the contrast between a large industrial, get-your-hands-all-greasy type organization like Springfield Remanufacturing and something that couldn't be much more white-collar than Dealey Renton. Another example, another way to get your hands dirty, is working in the earth. And a company called Organically Grown is one state away from us. And they're an organization which is partly owned by employees, partly owned by the growers, the farmers who produce the produce that Organically Grown sells. In contrast to them is a company called Publix Supermarkets, which is a chain based in the southeast part of the United States. And I'll just to make this interactive, does anybody have a guess about what makes Publix unique as an employee-owned company in the United States? It's the largest. It has 153,000 employee owners. And another company, if you haven't heard of this, there's a search engine you can use to find out about them. Google is almost in my neck of the woods. They're a company that uses the Silicon Valley model of employee ownership, not surprisingly, quite extensively. And I won't tell you a lot about them unless you'd like to ask, but One very interesting thing is how they did their public offering, which was that they set up another class of shares to ensure that the majority, the control voting rights of Google would remain with employees, most specifically with the founders, but also with employees in general. The publicly owned shares have either zero or very limited voting rights at Google. So that's a sense of the diversity of employee ownership, both in the United States and abroad. Let me talk to you about these 10 parameters. Each one of these could be a very long conversation, but let me make it a much more brief conversation, and I'd invite you to write down questions. We won't have time to talk about all of this, but I hope you'll feel free to tackle me out in the hall or at any point or send me an email. All of my contact information is in this presentation. I'd love to have these conversations with you. So first is how much of the workforce. Graham gave a clear answer that for it would be all or most of the workforce. I agree that that's where the power of employee ownership comes from. Another is how much of the company's equity. We've seen successful employee ownership with 5% of the ownership of the business, but I believe that the core of employee ownership is where there's significant amounts of ownership. That may be measured as a percentage of all the stock that a company has, but you can also say, how large is my stake as an employee owner relative to my compensation? I think both measures are an absolutely essential way to look at how large employee ownership is. Second is whether it's stock or stock-linked. And by stock, I mean a share of stock. And by stock-linked, I mean anything that's based on the value of a share of stock. So that might be a phantom rights plan where I get a bonus that's tied to the current value of the stock, but I don't actually get a share of stock. Another is how much, if anything, does an employee pay? And I'll get back to that in some of the specific cases of types of employee ownership in the United States. But there's some real wisdom in having employees not pay for their shares. And I understand at this point that can be a very difficult thing, and there is some value, of course, in setting up plans where employees do pay. But I think it's worth considering both options. How is ownership allocated among employees? Is it voluntary? Do I choose to buy some amount? Do we base it on organizational level? Do we base it on how much the people who earn more get more shares? Do we have everybody get the same amount? What are the conditions or the limits? If I give you a share of stock and then you leave the company next week, do you lose that share of stock? Do you have to meet some performance basis before the stock becomes vested? Is it simply a matter of waiting after 5 years you get some, after 6 years you get a little more, 7 years a little more? How do employees sell their ownership interest? Let me just mention that in the United States, there are different types of plans, but our main type of plan requires that the company provide a market for those shares for our unlisted companies. What's the impact on governance? And that can range from absolutely nothing with a stock-linked plan to a company that operates a lot more like Mondragon, where it truly is an employee-controlled company. How is stock valued? There's also a diversity of how stock is valued in the United States. One way, the most common way, is to hire an outside independent appraisal firm to calculate the value of a share of stock. Other companies may have a formula, or they may have the board of directors come up with a number that the board is comfortable with each year. And the next is changes in ownership structure. And there, the question is, do you want employee ownership to be available as a means to change who owns the company, or is it just part of compensation? Is it an ongoing part of compensation that doesn't change the ownership structure, or is it a way to take a publicly listed company and make it unlisted? Is it a way to take a company that I own and have it become a company that everybody in this room owns? So those are the parameters. Let me talk about the current status in the United States. And there are four categories of employee ownership that I'd like to cover. The first is employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs. I know you use that acronym also. Our ESOPs are quite different than yours, so I'll try to remember to say U.S. ESOP during the course of this presentation. A U.S. ESOP is governed by retirement law in the United States for a quirk. That has some benefits, perhaps along the lines of what Della and Michelle were saying. There are certainly some disadvantages to that. It's very long-term. But there are also some advantages. Another feature of employee stock ownership plans is that employees do not pay. It's a company benefit. The company provides shares to employees as a part of the employment package.
Next, employees do not own those shares. Employees are beneficiaries of a trust. The trust owns those shares. Now, here's a difference from the UK. In the UK, the model that Graham was talking about at the end there is where there's a trust which owns shares on behalf of employees. For us, each employee has an account, and a specific number of shares are in those accounts. Once those shares are vested, they're mine. I can't forfeit them. If I leave the company, I get the value of those shares. An ESOP can own any portion of the company. Often in listed companies, an ESOP will own 0.5%, 1%, 2%. But in general, the most common percentage owned by employees in the United States now is 100%. There are tax incentives, quite generous ones, that apply to the seller, to the company itself, to the employees. And there is substantial regulation. Both our Internal Revenue Service and Department of Labor are heavily involved in regulating ESOPs. So let me very quickly step through those 10 parameters and show how they work at an ESOP. The portion of the workforce in a U.S. ESOP, it covers all or almost everybody who meets minimal eligibility requirements. The portion of stock can be anything, as I said. It's stock, not stock link. It's a pure company contribution. In the vast majority of cases, there's no employee contribution at all. The allocation is almost always, 85% of cases, based on allocation. If I earn half as much as you, I get half as many shares of you each year. The only condition on those shares, generally speaking, is time. I become vested over time, either 100% vested after 3 years or 20% vested each year over a six-year period. The liquidity for the employees in listed companies is simply the market. For unlisted employees, the company is obligated, legally obligated, to provide a market for those shares. Governance is very limited in ESOPs. The law specifies 7 decisions over which employees have a right to direct the trustee how to vote the shares in their account, and those end up happening generally 0 times in the life of most ESOP companies. Valuation, obviously for listed companies, it's easy. For private companies, you need to have an annual outside valuation. And then ownership transition tool, it's an excellent ownership transition tool. The majority of employee-owned companies using ESOPs in the United States are transition tools. So the second category of employee ownership in the United States are equity compensation plans. This is a very broad category. It can count stock options and restricted stock, phantom stock, all the things that that we associate generally with Silicon Valley. So, well, just got to talk about that. They can be either incremental or full value plans, and either real equity or synthetic versions of equity. We have both tax-qualified and non-tax-qualified versions of almost all of these plans. And Graham and I have been walking with Angela, talking with a number of people about this. One way in which the UK and the US are extremely similar is in how we treat these plans. Stock options are taxed at exercise, or tax-qualified options may be taxed on the sale of stock. It's extremely difficult for me to imagine Silicon Valley working if options in the United States were taxed at vesting. Here's an example of how a non-qualified option might work. The third category is worker cooperatives. That's Modrogana's example. We have roughly 500 worker cooperatives in the United States. Employees need to buy a membership share. There are minor tax incentives in the United States. And workers always own 100% of the company, except in one of our states, Minnesota, which has put together a clever new law allowing a minority outside investment in a worker co-op. Here's how a worker co-op might be set up along those 10 parameters. Then the last category is everything else. There's company stock and retirement plans. There's direct ownership, whether that can be as a gift or as a purchase. Let me mention one category. I wish I had broken out in a little more detail is an employee stock purchase plan. An employee stock purchase plan is where the company offers a mechanism through which employees can buy shares, generally at a discount. Most employee stock purchase plans are in listed companies. They're generally tax-qualified plans. They generally offer a discount to the share price. And there are lots of them. They tend to own a fairly small amount of shares. The average is that about 0.3 percent of payroll is in the form of stock, and that about 0.5%, I should say per year, of the company's stock is given out in the form of a stock purchase plan. They also tend to be very concentrated. The majority of people who participate in a stock purchase plan are executives. Tax-qualified stock purchase plans need to be open to all employees, meeting minimum requirements, but generally only about 9% of companies have a majority of their non-supervisory employees that choose to participate in stock purchase plans. So last is, how much are there? There are roughly 11,000 ESOP companies, 10 million active participants. If you count people who are non-active participants, it's more like 13 million. Equity compensation plans, Lord knows the real number. Our best estimate is about 3,000. Stock purchase plans are more, about 4,000, and lots of participants. And then worker cooperatives, no one knows. Best estimate is about 500 worker cooperatives and about, 7,000 to 11,000 participants. And that's largely because we have a single worker cooperative that has 3,000 members. Interestingly, another way to look at the extent of employee ownership in the United States is from a sample of the U.S. workforce, where a huge number say that they own shares in the companies where they work. This is from the General Social Survey, which is out of the University of Illinois. Just a glimpse of what industries ESOPs are in. Much of the rest of the data in this will focus on ESOPs, since they are sort of the core of employee ownership in the United States. They're a very even cross-section of the economy. There's a whole lot of them in manufacturing. A few places where ESOPs don't show up very much are in companies that have fewer than 20 employees, companies that have very high turnover. They don't tend to be in fast food, quick service. And they tend not to be in industries where there's a very high ratio of asset to payroll. Some of the major forces at work now in the United States are demographics. We have a lot of people who are just entering or just about to enter the age where they want to retire. Many of them own businesses. Many of them are going to be selling the businesses they own to their employees. We expect a large increase, and we've already starting to see a large increase in the number of employee-owned businesses. Another force right now in the United States is the pressure on wages. Obviously, that's everywhere because of globalization. But at the same time, there's a war for talent. One of the ways to do that, obviously Silicon Valley's response, is to give out a lot of stock options. I think that's coming into a lot of other companies as well, where they need to give people something of value without causing unsustainable cash pressure now. Another is the movement of the stock markets. Obviously, there's been the stock market has been excruciatingly confusing for the last bunch of years. And that has a big impact on the extent to which employees are interested in employee ownership. Employees tend to lag the stock market by a bit. There's also some very interesting emerging academic research, and I'll just share with you some of the academics who are doing research right now on employee ownership. Bottom one, Ilona Babenko, just came out with a report on the connection between ESPPs and company stock performance. Turns out that the companies that have higher levels of voluntary employee participation in their stock purchase plans have higher stock, better stock performance over the following 1 and 2 years than companies with lower participation rates. So it seems employees aren't just lagging indicators of stock performance. Another thing I'll mention is there's a new film that's just come out, We the Owners. Please go to wetheowners.com. You'll enjoy it. There's wonderful stories of different types of employee-owned businesses. Then there's domestic politics is very interesting right now. As with every country, although we would love to have 7% of, our debt be 7% of GDP, there's incredible pressure on budgets right now. The Obama administration has proposed eliminating one of the tax incentives that support one type of employee ownership. They estimate that it will save roughly $700 million a year. There's a big focus. Jobs is the word in the United States now. That is the political currency. That's what everybody is trying to deliver. Every policymaker is trying to deliver. And there's some wonderful research. I'll share that with you in a minute, too. Interestingly, the conflict around employee ownership in the United States is not between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. It generally seems to be between parts of the executive branch and the legislature. So, is it left or right? Favorite political picture. So this is Bernie Sanders. I don't know if folks know him, but he is the only self-proclaimed socialist in the U.S. Senate. He's a wonderful supporter of employee ownership. And then this is Mitch McConnell, whom you also may have heard of. He's a little bit, not quite as left, shall we say, as Bernie Sanders. He's the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. He's also a very active supporter of employee ownership. In fact, both Bernie Sanders on the far left and the Tea Party are the largest sources of support for employee ownership in the United States. It tends to be the middle, the right of the Democratic Party, the left of the Republican Party, that's a bit more lukewarm about employee ownership. So is it left or right? Here are a couple of quotes from real politicians. The wealth of our nation should be more widely held. That's why I support employee ownership. Or the capitalistic system should have a whole lot more capitalists. That's why I support employee ownership. That's the left, that's the right. Now what's interesting about this is both of these quotes are from the same person. So forgive me, maybe too provocative. So is it left? Is it right? Yes. It is. Employee ownership is the Rorschach blot test of politics. So I think you can build a very interesting case, a very interesting coalition. We're not at the point of having all the all-party backing for it that the UK does, but let me give you a very brief history. So here's the 19th century, the Knights of Labor. One part of this is the Knights of Labor are an old labor organization, one of the founders of the labor movement. And one of their goals was to build a worker co-op society in the United States. More recently, two men had dinner. One of them was Senator Russell Long, and he was a Democrat from Louisiana. The other was Louis Kelso, a lawyer from San Francisco. And Kelso had the idea for something he called an employee stock ownership plan. And during that dinner, he sold Russell Long on that idea. What's interesting about Russell Long is he was the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, which means arguably the most powerful person in the Senate. He is the reason that we have the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, which went into effect in 1974. This is the reason we have ESOPs in the United States. This is our big bang. Now, there have been a lot of small bangs since then. Lots of legislation has modified employee ownership since then. Some of it has made it weaker. Much of it has made it stronger. But the point is, it all goes back to Russell Long and to this 1974 legislation. Russell Long, by the way, is the person who gave both of those quotes about wider distribution of wealth and more capitalists. So that's a very brief history. We're still living, to a large extent, on modest increments to that big bang from 40 years ago. So the impact of employee ownership. All of these slides, by the way, are publicly available on a new sort of sub-website that we launched called esopinfo.org. I warmly welcome you to go use that, and please circulate widely. Employee ownership tends to keep businesses in business. Employee-owned companies are less likely to go bankrupt, less likely to be acquired. They're rooted locally. Employee owners are far less likely to be laid off, four times less likely to be laid off in the latest recession. Employee ownership builds wealth both for its employees. Employees who work in ESOP companies have about 2.5 times as much retirement wealth through company-sponsored plans compared to people who work for comparable non-employee-owned companies. They also earn more in wages, so it's not a trade-off. Employee ownership improves business performance by increasing productivity. It makes for higher job growth, so not just fewer layoffs, but more new jobs are created by employee-owned businesses. The return on assets in employee-owned companies is substantially higher, and increases and sales increases year on year by 2.4% in employee-owned businesses. So we've got 40 years of data now on employee ownership and its impact on the economy, on employees, and on communities and businesses. I mentioned esopinfo.org. We also put together a map, so you can see where employee-owned companies are around the United States. This is our state of Washington. Employee ownership and unemployment. If you take those numbers about the impact of employee ownership on unemployment, This is the raw data from the General Social Survey. It's pretty easy to do math with that. And if you do the math, and you estimate how much unemployment costs the federal government, then if you take that 2.6% layoff rate that employee-owned companies had, and instead let's run the counterfactual world where they had the 12.1% layoff rate that everybody else did, if we didn't have the employee ownership effect, if we didn't have employee-owned companies preserving jobs and preventing layoffs, the United States would have had 1.8 million more unemployed people in 2010. Employee ownership saves the federal government $23 billion in 2010. In non-recession years, it's lower. It's only $14 billion. Now, this isn't a full picture. There are costs to the federal government as well. This doesn't count the foregone tax revenue from the tax shields to employee ownership. This is just the benefit in terms of preventing unemployment. This is from a report that we did, which is freely available on our website. I'd be more than happy to send it to you as well. There's a shared capitalism research project which found four factors that made employee-owned businesses more successful, and they're these. So employee ownership on its own creates benefits on average, as some of those prior slides showed. But what really makes it stand out is when companies have the success factors combined with employee ownership. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. Everybody wants it. It's also 4% of the businesses that sort of fall in the general category of making sense to have an ESOP. There are about 4% of businesses in the United States have an ESOP. So why isn't there more? I'd say it's there are many reasons. One is that there are myths that it's too expensive. It isn't cheap to set up an ESOP. It can cost $100,000. If you compare that to other ways you can sell your business to someone else, it doesn't start to look so bad. If you look at how much it costs to sell a business to another firm and all the complexities, risks, and uncertainties in that, it starts to look like a better deal. Executives, I believe, are motivated by stock, but I believe that everybody is motivated by stock. And I think the research data from the States and from the UK demonstrate that quite clearly. I know Graham mentioned that there's sort of a myth that the only cool way to exit your business is by floating or by selling to a sexy company. And I think that's simply wrong. I think that's a flashy and, frankly, service provider-driven way of looking at what happens to our businesses when we leave them. Corey Rosen, who founded the NCEO, talks often about how people come to him all the time and say, you know, people don't really need ownership. They need a sense of ownership. They need to own their jobs. They need to own the responsibility for making this company work well. Well, imagine you went into a restaurant and you're going with a friend and the friend says, ooh, look at that. Smell this. I'm going to get this lunch. Do you want to smell it? Great, yeah. But you can't have any. You can have lunch. You can have a sense of lunch. You can't have lunch. I'm eating. You're not. I mean, that's sort of a cheap way to put it, but I think there's really something to it. There's no substitute for the real thing. There's no substitute for lunch, and there's no substitute for ownership. So the other one is Marxist. We've talked about that. It's not Marxist. It's pure capitalism, right? Well, I'll say that to one side. It's pure capitalism, right? It's a great left approach to building a more just society. Some of the other reasons there's not more employee ownership in the United States. I believe our service provider community has some biases. There are complexities in setting up employee ownership. And if I'm your CPA and you say, hey, can you help me set up an employee stock ownership plan, and I don't know how to do it, I'm not going to say, yeah, I think that's a great idea. Why don't you hire my competitor over here who knows how to do it? What I'm more likely to say is, no, that's a really bad idea. I've heard these horrible things about it. So I think there are clearly some biases in the service provider community. In the business journalism world, it's really fun to talk about fires, flames, disasters, and plane crashes, right? It's not much fun to talk about simple success, about companies doing well year after year after improving how they do things. So I think there's a bias towards disaster in journalism, and I think that makes people scared of employee ownership. As Graham said, I won't repeat this, a lack of awareness is clearly a huge issue. And the simple issue is it's not easy to do employee ownership right. It's not automatic. It's not, as they say, falling off a log. Let me tell you about another dinner. This is slightly different. This is me and my aunt and uncle, my little niece, and her boyfriend. Her boyfriend works for an employee-owned company. So I asked him, what's it like? He said, well, you know, they talk about it being employee-owned. They say we're an employee-owned company. But when they say that, all they mean is we own stock. So in his mind, what's going on? Owning stock does not make him an employee owner, right? It's not about owning shares. For him, in his mind, what makes it an employee-owned company, what would make it an employee-owned company, is for the company to treat him like an owner, the company to show him respect, to value his opinion, to educate him, to do all the things that we think of when we think of an employee-owned business. Doing that is not easy. It's not as easy as signing the papers that the lawyers bring to you. So, some lessons. I put these in three categories. Let me actually pause for a second here. These lessons are the squishiest bit, and knowing me, I could spend 4 hours on each of them. So, do people have questions? I mean, I'd like to make sure that we had a chance to make this interactive as well. Yes, please.
Peng Lee from ASIC. Just had a question about the obligation on unlisted companies to buy back the shares.
Yes.
And that you mentioned that they do an annual valuation.
Yes.
Is that the basis on which the value that's required to be paid is calculated?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. So the annual valuation determines how much the repurchase obligation will be each year. And a typical company repurchases 2 to 5% of its shares each year.
And is there a particular time that has to take place and relative to when the valuation occurs, or?
Yes. So companies wrap up their fiscal year. It usually takes 4 or 5 months. In some companies, it takes up to 9 months until they get the valuation back. And then they need to pay based on that valuation as soon as practicable.
Thank you.
Just carrying on from that, is there any regulation as to what market value is?
Yes, there is a boatload. There's probably more regulation about that than fits in the entire tax code of Cambodia. There's no certification for valuation firms in the United States, but federal regulation sets up 15, I think, are the number of tick boxes that need to be checked about factors that go into valuation. One of the big controversies right now in the United States has been the Department of Labor feeling that the valuations are sometimes not done right, that they overvalue the transaction, they undervalue later, that they work in the interest of sellers. So there's a big controversy now in the United States about how the industry self-polices or whether the Department of Labor is going to require more people to be legally responsible for the integrity of the valuation. Specifically, they're thinking of requiring that the valuation firms themselves be considered fiduciaries of the plan. All right, we'll do some lessons then. I broke this into three bits. One's for business leaders, one is for non-managers, and one is for people involved in the policy side of things. For business leaders, it doesn't work without ownership. We talked about the idea of a sense of lunch. In terms of how you think about employee ownership, I think it's good to think of an almost overly cute catchphrase, which is to think about value, valuation, and values. If you talk about how much a plan might be worth, its value, that's a good way to get people's attention. We have a lot of firms that put together little Excel spreadsheets so people can enter their assumptions about how the stock price is going to change over the years, how much their salary is going to change relative to other people's, you know, the overall compensation, what contribution levels might be like. And that lets them project in 20 years what the value of their ESOP account might be. So that's a good way to get people's attention. It's also a good way to raise people's expectations too high and make them disappointed if they get less than $63 billion when they retire. So we've seen companies find ways to have it be a conversation rather than a self-done exercise. In terms of valuation, I think in the United States, this is one of the most overlooked aspects of employee ownership education. People need to understand, in unlisted companies, the relationship between what I do, how that affects profit, and how profit affects the value of a share of stock. And it's very tempting for people to focus on some of these early bits, but if people can make the leap to seeing all the way from saving $10,000 to creating X to the value of each share of stock, that's powerful. For example, one of our member companies did all the math. They crunched the numbers in the valuation report, and they said, if you can save $10,000, then that adds 2 cents to the value of each share of stock. And if that lets them do some really nice math, right? If everybody, if all 300 people in this case, can save $10,000, that creates $6 per share of stock, and I've got a lot of shares of stock. So it does a lot to create that connection. I mean, to me, one of the really interesting things about what Della and Michelle were saying is a 50% chance. I think that implies a coin flip, and we don't have any impact over which side of a coin flips up. I don't care so much whether executives or employees would prefer to have money now or a chance of money later. I want them to have skin in the game as a business owner. I would rather have them be a little uncomfortable today. One of our very smart CEOs said one of the ways you get to a successful employee ownership culture is by cultivating a constant sense of mild dissatisfaction. And I think there's really something to that. You want people worried about next year's, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, the performance of the company. So valuation, get people to focus on valuation. Get people also to focus on values, because that's even more fundamental. People make lots of decisions based on money, but they don't make some of the most profound decisions based on money. People, as I say, they join a company and they quit a boss. They quit because their life satisfaction at the business is not sufficient. The businesses we see that do an amazing job of building employee ownership are the businesses where there are intangible things that the companies do that make people feel included. They build a sense of membership. One of our members is New Belgium Brewing, a company that is based in Colorado. And their CEO is a woman who has a background in social work. And she's done an amazing job of doing things that make people feel almost tribal, almost part of a family at the business. And it's truly amazing what they've done, what they've invested, flying people from all over the country to their annual meetings every year, doing all sorts of little symbolic things, rituals. And the result has been fantastic bottom line, fantastic for the bottom line, but it comes from a sense of valuing people. It's a marathon, not a sprint. It's very easy to say, well, put this ownership plan into place and carry on. That should do it. It takes constant investment in education and getting people involved and reminding people why ownership is worth it. Be ready for cynics. You will have cynics. We do employee surveys of employee owners. And the most successful companies we've seen still have some, well, maybe not some cynics, but at least some skeptics. The vast majority of companies still do have cynics. And I think that's fine. Your cynics can be friends when you're trying to figure out how to present messages. They can also be, we've seen companies do crazy things like take their cynics and put them on the board of directors, and then it's a risky move, but it's done some amazing things for the credibility of employee ownership. We've also seen companies take the opposite approach, that when one of our companies, King Arthur Flour, which has been making baker's flour in Vermont since 1790, they became employee-owned 10 or so years ago. After that, they hit a downturn. They needed to do some layoffs. Oddly enough, somehow there weren't as many cynics after the layoffs. One of the most important things we've seen come up in different companies is to support the middles in your business. And by that I mean the people who are not executives, but they supervise other people, the middle managers, supervisors. Based on the survey results, these are the people who are most likely to be cynical about employee ownership. And if you think about that, that's a disaster. These are the people you depend on to everybody. If they don't buy it, if people come to them with a question about employee ownership and they have to keep saying, gosh, I don't know, or they keep giving a negative spin on it, that's a disaster for your employee ownership. In the United States, I always tell people that you don't want to talk about how wonderful employee ownership is because it sounds like you're selling something. People don't trust it when you're selling it. Give them the facts, let them decide. The facts are pretty damn good. And then put people on the hook, by which I mean it's tempting when you're trying to build a warm, happy, productive, positive work culture to take people off the hook, to say, oh yeah, that's fine, whatever. But I think what people really, really grow from is responsibility and accountability for the decisions they make from day to day. Hold people accountable for all sorts of things, for their own the results of their own job, for promoting the culture. Some of our members have job descriptions for their middle managers that say, part of your job is to educate people and promote employee ownership and promote the behaviors that we expect from everybody. It's scary. It's scary to be a middle manager or an executive in an employee-owned company because you're taking chances. You're letting go of things, things that matter profoundly to you. It's a little bit like having your kid go off to college or drive for the first time. You have to trust people, and you have to take a leap of faith, and that is scary. But it's worth it. So, for employee owners, it can make you richer. I've talked about the statistics. I won't go through those again. If you're an employee owner, it can be a good thing for your pocket. It can also make your work life better. The job levels of job satisfaction, turnover, things like that are far better in employee-owned companies. You can feel it when you walk into a Clayton Bank. You can feel it when you walk into to businesses like New Belgium Brewing. It's a different way of doing business. One thing that Graham and I have frequently come back to in conversations is it's not a different business strategy. It's a different business model. It's a different environment. It's a different organism when it's working right. And it's a much more satisfying one to work in. It does not work without shared responsibility. As employee owners, you should want to be on the hook. You should want to take adult responsibility for the success of your organization. And for you as well. Employee owners find employee ownership scary. It's a new level of responsibility. It's a new level of risk. It's a new way of thinking about your involvement at the job. It makes your work part of you in a way which is both wonderful and terrifying. One of the things that we often see happen in employee-owned businesses is that managers take a leap of faith and employees don't. And then employees say, oh, well, maybe. But by that time, the managers are backed off and feeling burnt and not doing it. The magic of employee ownership happens when everybody at the business is willing to take that leap of faith at the same time. So, policymakers. It's an effective way to increase employment. It does amazing things for preventing layoffs and for generating new jobs. It should not replace other retirement plans. 2 points. First is it's not about having all your eggs in one basket. Employee ownership is almost always in addition to another retirement plan than a substitute for a retirement plan. In fact, an employee-owned company is more likely to have a retirement plan than companies in general are to have any retirement plans. So employee-owned companies are more likely to have two plans than other companies are to have zero, which I expect sounds barbaric to you. We have companies that have no retirement benefits at all for their employees. The other argument against that is that employee-owned companies tend to contribute much more to their ESOPs than they would if they didn't have an ESOP, and that's because it's often an ownership transition. And as an owner, I don't want to wait 50 years until I've got my money. I want to get it done in 7 or 10. So we increase the contribution rates. So the fact is, I do have more eggs in this basket, but it's a much bigger basket. It's a 2.5 times bigger basket. And I'd say it's far better to be 50% diversified in a big basket than 100% diversified in a much smaller basket. Another piece about how to build the policy is I think it makes a lot of sense to give tax benefits or tax structure or legal structure to what companies do, not how they do it. Although I think everybody who looks at it agrees that managing companies by building an ownership culture, by managing participatively makes companies work better, it doesn't make sense to make that part of the legal framework. Our approach in the United States is to open it up to say companies can manage themselves any old way they want to, minimum governance requirements. And we think that some portion of companies will begin to act employee-owned. And we think the portion that act employee-owned will be far bigger than the total number would have been if we had mandated a management approach. Awareness and accurate information, I think, is a central role for government.